Welcome to the month seven Investable ETR briefing. It covers the trading period from the 1st of July to the 31st of July. As the briefing document explains, exchange-traded receivables are leases, monetary obligations, are bills issued under contract for assets, goods, and services that are supplied to investment quality companies, or are credit insured invoices from investment grade insurers. So what this means is that an ETR is evidence of a debt owing from one company to another. Typically, these tend to be large companies or banks that are household names, and they owe money to their smaller micro to medium sized suppliers. We call these micro to medium sized supplier businesses originators because they originate the debt obligation transactions that create the ETR that are ultimately traded on the exchange. So the ETR is evidence of the large company's liability to pay the smaller one and credit exchange by these ETR at a nominal discount to their face value. In doing so, when the ETR are settled or paid in full, the difference between the face value that it is settled and the discounted price that it was purchased at creates a margin. And it's that margin that creates the yield or return for investors. Credit exchange also provides other credit facilities to other types of transactions, such as trade finance, asset finance, and others. Essentially, they all work on the same principles that the traded ETR is a business transaction. The exchange provides liquidity, and we're paid a commission for doing so, much in the same way a bank charges interest. As with last month's briefing, I'm going to explain this a little further by giving you a couple of examples. If you look at the center of the briefing document, you'll see a list of the top 10 largest investable ETR holdings. As with last month, the question was, why would a company like Tarmac or Nestle be borrowing money from credit? Or indeed, why would the HSE, which is the Irish Government Health Service, be in need of finance from credit? And the answer is they are not. It is the companies that supply Tarmac, Nestle, or indeed the HSE that are using credit to finance their business. For the purposes of this example, let's say there's a micro to medium-sized business called Amalgamated Transport Services. And this company supplies transport services to Tarmac, Nestle, and the HSE. All three of these companies are great customers to have, but the issue for Amalgamated Transport Services that we call an originator, because they are supplying business and services to Tarmac, Nestle, and HSE, they originate the business that ultimately becomes an invoice. So once they've done whatever pickups and delivery they need to, Amalgamated will issue invoices to those three companies for the services that they've supplied. And it is these invoices that Amalgamate issue to Tarmac, Nestle, and the HSE that we call exchange-traded receivables, or ETR. The issue for Amalgamated is that every time they issue an invoice to Tarmac or the HSE for the services that they provide, it can take 60 or more days for that ETR to get paid. So if Amalgamated is a fast-growing company, the more business it conducts with these three companies, the more credit they have to offer them. Or, said another way, the more finance they need to cash flow their business while they wait to get paid. That's why, in this example, Amalgamated Transport Services comes to us here at Credit, because if they want to continue supplying more and more services to Tarmac, Nestle, and the HSE, they need more and more cash to run their business while they're waiting to get paid. So let's say one of the invoices to Nestle has a total face value of 10,000. And as I said, that invoice is what we call an exchange trade receivable, or ETR. How credit exchange works is that we purchase the invoice from Amalgamated, and in buying it, we only pay 80% of its face value on the day that we purchase it. Amalgamated are happy because they have 80% of the value of their invoice on the day they issued it. And as a result of the transaction, Credit Exchange are the 100% owner of it. So while Credit waits 60 days for the 10,000 to be paid, the originator, in this example, Amalgamated Transport Services, is happy to take the 8,000 payment on the day they issued their invoice, and they also wait for another 60 days before they get the balance of the other 20%, less whatever fees and commissions we charge them. At the same time, Credit now owns 100% of an asset worth 10,000 that we only paid 8,000 for. And it's this 20% that we call the reserve on that ETR. So as explained last month, the reserves do several things for the credit exchange. Firstly, it acts as a strong incentive for the originator to properly manage their credit control to make sure Nestle, Tarmac, and indeed the HSE pay their invoice on day 60, because Amalgamated still wants the 20% remaining that is still owed to them. Secondly, because Credit has a 20% reserve on every invoice that Amalgamated sells to us, and not only on the invoices they issued to Nestle, but also the ones issued to Tarmac, the HSE, and any other debtors they sold us. So at any moment in time, we could have 10, 50, or even more ETR we own, and therefore we have 10 or 50 other ETR that we purchase for 80% of their face value. Using that 20%, if there is any invoice in the entire bucket of invoices that the originator sold to us that gets distressed or delayed or for any reason isn't paid on time, we simply use the reserve to make that ETR whole, and by doing so, we have removed the risk to any investor that holds that ETR. In this particular case, comes to day 60, Nestle pay the 10,000. We only pass on 1,900 to Amalgamated, and we keep 100 euro for providing the finance service to them in the first place. And it is that 100 euro that we use to run and operate our business, and more importantly, to pay yields or interest to your investors. You may recall from last month's briefing, I mentioned that although the active RSA and allocation figures remain constant, the value of trade increased by more than 40%, which means we're putting more money to work without changing how we manage it or the mandates we are following. Maintaining solid underlying figures means we're using our funds more efficiently, even though we're continuing to grow the business. Which leads me to this month's briefing, where, as the document states, at the end of July, Credit Exchange held active RSA of 70.59 million, which is marginally up on last month's figure. As you all know, RSA stands for Revolving Sale Agreement, and a Revolving Sale Agreement is a document or contract between the micro to medium-sized business or the originator, like Amalgamated Transport Services in the example I gave earlier, and Credit Exchange. So the Revolving Sale Agreement is a commitment by that originator to sell a certain value of ETR to the exchange in any given period. Typically, this is for 1 year. So, for example, let's say an originator needs a trade credit facility, a trade credit revolving facility, of 1 million to run their business. They will come to Credit, much like they would to a bank, and apply for that credit facility of 1 million on a revolving basis every 60 days. This means they must sell to us 1 million worth of ETR every 60 days, and the revolving sale agreement, or RSA, will be for 6 million worth of ETR over a 12-month period. This commitment to sell 6 million of ETR annually to Credit Exchange is documented in the RSA with the credit group. Similarly, if we were looking at a leasing transaction where the originator wants to buy an asset for, let's say, 5 million over 5 years, this would result in total payments over 60 months of approximately 6 million. meaning that for each of the 60 months, the originator would pay credit 10,000 every month. Each one of these payments is an ETR, and collectively the total 6 million is part of the active revolving sale agreements we report on at these briefings each month. These active RSA contracts continue to be short as trading patterns and speed of settlement continue to keep the cash-to-cash life cycle short, with the ever-increasing use of trade and shipping costs, keep the cash-to-cash cycle short with the ever-increasing use of trade and shipping trade, shipping, and freight finance. Trade finance, in its purest form, meaning that we support mining-related projects, commodity trades, and shipping-related transactions as a core competency and principal activity on the trade desk. The next figure in the briefing states that there was 67.10 million of investors' funds fully allocated. As you know, this means that we have just over 70.7 million of investors' funds in the market. And when you add that to the 80.59 million of RSA, or revolving sale agreements, that represent future orders we have that are not yet filled, this amounts to over 150 million in trade we have on our books at the end of July. For 2022 and overall, this figure has continued to rise each month and shows strong and stable growth as we put more money into the market. Moving to investors' redemptions, I'm glad to see a significant drop on that number by more than 50% in July, where withdrawals dropped from 1.34 million in June to under 600,000 or 0.58 million in July. This is now part of a consistent and familiar pattern of peaks and troughs in receipts and withdrawals from investors, and is one of the reasons why we are raising additional debt to support our expansion in the markets we've chosen to focus on. Looking to the Baltic Index, which is the index against which most shipping contracts are linked, things are not looking good here. Neither does the prices showing the FFA market look good either. The index continues to have a turbulent time, and though it was generally looking like an upward trend at the beginning of the year, it's taken a turn for the worse. Nothing to be too alarmed about, but it would seem my briefing back in March about rising inflation and warning of recession or even depression as far back as April may be coming true. The Baltic Index started the year at 2300 in January and is currently down at 1270, so it's almost off by 55%. But this is a combination of issues relating to easing in the supply chain for the third month in a row to the end of July, and an overall fear of the future due to dollar-euro parity as it is today, and of course, inflationary concern. So this continues to be a very hard market to read right now. However, and I stated at prior briefings, when you mix the inflationary pressure with the supply and demand issues caused by the European emissions control for shipping under their EEX slow steaming legislation that comes into effect on the 1st of January next year, we're still quite a distance away from where we were 2 years ago. As stated last month, there's an already depleted world fleet, and next year these ships have to slow down by an average of 15%, meaning the cargoes they carry are going to take longer to deliver and cost more to do so. The FFA market confirmed a position last month where the Panamax 4TC FFA rates were generally hovering around the 20,000 mark and looked like they might hold until the end of this year and into quarter one of 2023. These have come off a lot in the last 4 weeks, where rates have dropped to an average of 15,000, with a further decline showing for 2023 Q1 where prices are currently showing in the mid to high 12,000s. This is back at 2020 levels. As at prior briefings, the FFA markets are the derivative financial futures that predict cargo transport prices ahead of time. And when you combine these with the Baltic Index, together they provide a pretty good indication of how the market's most likely to behave. Last month, we saw there was a significant drop heading into 2024, and it seems the market has pulled all the way back, and these numbers are now showing in the first quarter of 2023. It would be remiss of me not to point out that the majority of our vessels and those we're currently seeking to finance are in the offshore sector, where market dynamics are chart bursting at the moment. Several years back, I was told that some two-thirds of the Northern Hemisphere's vessels, offshore vessels, were laid up or had been sent to demolition. For the last 2 years and more, there wasn't a lot of offshore work, but as the world started to get back to business, meaning the oil and gas business, there's now a shortage of available vessels worldwide. When you then look at the surging demand for offshore vessels capable of supplying wind energy projects, the rates that some of these vessels are commanding are eye-watering. Take, for example, a Jones Act vessel we're in negotiations to finance. This particular vessel is expected to earn between $40,000 and $50,000 a day. Relative to its cost at $3.5 million, technically, this vessel could repay its entire purchase price in less than 6 months. And it's these type of niche market plays that credits are known for, and is also the reason why we've been able to increase the buy rate to investors last month. We do need additional funding to meet the strong deal supply like this one and others that are in our pipeline. A quick Google search of the current state of the EU's position on inflation, induced recession, and you're immediately struck with some concerning numbers coming out of Germany, where consumer retail sales slumped some 8.8% in July. And yet, this is in stark contrast to the Eurozone's overall economy, which reportedly grew during quarter two of this year. However, we're looking at the behavior in companies rather than consumer spending. And in July, Reuters reported that the Eurozone manufacturing is sinking into an increasingly steep downturn, adding to the region's recession risks. New orders are already falling at a pace which, excluding pandemic lockdown months, is the sharpest drop since the debt crisis back in 2012, and worse is likely to come. Chris Williamson, the chief business economist at S&P Global, does say that lower than anticipated sales reflected in accelerating rates of decline of new orders and exports have led to the largest rise in unsold stocks of finished goods ever recorded in the history of the S&P Global Survey. He goes on to say the production was falling in all countries surveyed other than the Netherlands, and that the rate of decline was particularly worrying in Germany, France, and Italy, which make up the EU bloc's three biggest economies. When you combine that with news coming out of the US, where its economy unexpectedly contracted last quarter, raising the risk that it too was on the verge of recession, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen touted the administration's achievements over the last 18 months and described the economy as resilient, but even she acknowledged that activity was slowing and warned of numerous risks on the horizon. This has to be an acknowledgement that inflation rose at an 8.2 rate in the first half of this year and is the fastest increase in inflation since 1981. Quickly looking at the market research from Seaborn, from their weekly shipping research report, they summarize important events that will impact markets, and they focus on inflationary concerns, citing the International Monetary Fund, the IMF's report on the latest economic outlook published last week, the IMF lowered for a third consecutive time this year its world growth expectations, stressing that downside risks on its baseline scenario dominate, while the organization's chief economist warned that the world may soon be teetering on the edge of a global recession, only 2 years after the last one. Downward revisions have been made to the growth of all major economies, including the US, China, India, and the Euro area. And with war in the Ukraine on top of the pandemic resurgence in H1, is creating a perfect storm leading towards stagflation as high price environments and a slowing down economic growth rate are taking place at the same time. So dodging stagflation is probably one of the trickiest tasks, as the response to softening growth and inflation are diametrically opposing. The former is dealt with by pouring money into economies, which eventually results in lower interest rates and faster spending, and the latter with restricting the flow of money and enforcing higher rates to reduce spending and normalize prices. With governments around the world digesting lower growth better than inflation at this stage, focus has shifted on targeting inflation. To reverse inflation, one can either expect or push for the global supply shocks that are lifting prices up to resolve, or interest rates can be raised high enough to dampen demand and reduce prices of finished goods and commodities. As moderating supply shocks is not realistically easy, given the current geopolitical environment, the scenario of additional rate hikes and eventually curb demand is the most plausible, which in terms of overall shipping rates means performance is not an ideal one. And what this all means thus to us here at Credit is that when inflation causes prices to rise, the demand for credit increases too. And that has been good for companies in our industry that are poised to reap that benefit. As this briefing is about July's trades, the dip in trading results from April and June saw a healthy rebound in July, coming in at 18.44 million for the month. This reverses the two dips from April and June and has helped to keep the exchange to remain some 17% ahead of all prior trading years when comparing year-on-year performance. Looking at Treasury performance, as you'd expect, it lagged behind at 14.11 million and showed a 27% increase on collections for June. And on a contributing factor, there has been a lowering of the credit index. The ETR average duration figure was 67 days, and this is an historical low for the exchange. The credit index has been holding fast at the 70s mark since April, but at 67, it's never been lower at any time in the exchange's 10-year history. As explained at prior briefings, a stable credit index allows for better planning and management by the trade desk, who it seems have risen to the challenge of reducing this number to its historic low. As you all know, the credit index is the ETR average duration or number of days it takes for an ETR to get settled. So the credit index is the cash to cash cycle from the day an ETR is issued and purchased in cash, and the number of days it takes for the debt to be extinguished or settled and the cash returned. The credit index is one of our economic indicator of our market, that is, the one we're trading. So it's back to normal. And as I said, we've reached an all-time low at 67 during the month of July. Moving to the center of the document, this is where we list the 10 largest investable ETR holdings and the top 10 rated holdings. The left side list shows what companies or organizations owed the exchange the largest amounts of money, as at the 31st of July. And as usual, you can see the HSE remains an all but constant, and is one of three sovereign risk entities that include both Laois County Council in Ireland and Lancashire County Council in the UK. Then we have Nestlé remaining for its fourth consecutive month with a repeat of Balfour Beatty for the third time and Tarmac for their second month. Then we have Riverdale Commodities making its debut, and this company is headquartered in Geneva, which is a powerhouse for some of the world's largest commodity traders. Riverdale has traded more than 2 billion of crude oil and refined petroleum products, in addition to iron ore, coke, and coal. As you'll see under the performance section of the briefing, this was the largest single trade on the exchange for the month of July. Moving to the top 10 rated investable ETF on the right-hand side, there's the regular appearance of Transport Supplies, Venus Wood, and Truckline. These are the highest rated debtors, and apart from Nestlé and Tarmac, as none of these were investment grade or have an investment grade rating on the 31st of March, this list shows the selection of these organizations regardless of the amount of their liability and is simply a selection of the most creditworthy. Moving to the pie chart below these two lists shows a well-diversified spread of ETR across the market. Healthy Community comes in at 16 2/3% and continues to hover between 16 and 19 as it has done for most of this year. Wholesale Retail rose slightly above its 25 to 26 mark, coming in at almost 28, with Food and Beverage down 0.5 point to 6.48%. Manufacturing rose 2 points to 11.11, which is remaining firm, whilst construction picked up some of its lost ground from June, coming back in at 19.44, and continues to look stable due to the mining and national infrastructure trades we support for projects that are being undertaken in the UK. Looking to the performance section of the briefing document, you see a continuing pattern in the trade for July 2021 versus July 2022, where volumes continue to be 40% lower year on year, but values remain up. This means that for the better part of a year, and perhaps a little more, our ETR are now coming in consistently higher in value than they were a year ago. As stated last month, this kind of makes sense when you consider who our debtors are and the industry sectors we're focusing on. We traded over 80 million in 2021, and as you can see, we traded almost another 15 million, or a total of 94.67 million to the end of July 2022. The credit index of 67, noted as an historic low for the exchange, I've already talked about. And to finish on our performance in July, the largest single trade was a trade finance deal of just over 2.9 million that, as explained earlier, was a coal trade out of Durban into Gdansk in Poland, where no doubt the government there is making sure that no matter what happens in Russia in 2022, Poland will still have stockpiled coal to combat any shortage in gas supplies coming from their next door neighbors. As explained in the investable brochure and at other briefings, for many years now, we've had an average ETR value of some 2,000 euro. This has been rising since the beginning of the year. Looking to July's figures, the average value of an ETR has risen steadily and is now an average of 5,350 euro. This doubling in the average value of an ETR is nothing significant, really, and is more of an indication that the volume to value ratio has been increasing in line with larger trades. Finally, let's move to the trend section of the July briefing, where you can see that the investor's yield or buy price was pretty stable overall during July, despite for a brief downward spike on July 22nd. The line chart started at 2.076% and ended at 2.139%. The spread is half a point, and like May and June, the 2.1 position held stable for the month. As you know, supply has been increasing all year, and on the 13th of July, we pushed the rate to 3.75% to try to match supply with demand from investors. This hasn't had the desired effect yet, in terms of bringing in additional funding and underpins the board's decision to raise money in the debt markets from institutional investors. We're still at the early to mid stages of this process and will report any significant developments as they occur. Ultimately, in order to grow our market size, investors' appetite isn't meeting our current retail investors' appetite isn't meeting the supply from originators. As always, and to remind you, the negative yields to zero yield on bank deposits that your retail investors are now being offered is considerably shy of the 3.750% and 4.750% that they are receiving by investing in investable exchange-traded receivables rather than letting their cash languish unattended in the bank. As you know, this rate changes daily and can be checked anytime on the investable.com website. To finish the briefing, you will see a repeat of the active RSA, a revolving sale agreement of 80.59 million, and that concludes this month's briefing for July 2022. Thank you.